All right, Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. If you don't have a Bible, hit that QR code with your phone, and it will open up to our passage where we'll be for the entirety of our time. And it'll be really helpful for you to see what's going on, because it'll be all the more confusing if you don't see it literally in the black and white on the page or on the screen. I've entitled this message, God's Almanac. And for our younger generations, you don't probably know altogether what an almanac is. But for previous generations, and especially those who are of an older persuasion in our midst, almanacs were a pretty big deal. They were a big deal for us as a country in the early days of colonial America. But almanacs go back 4,000 years to the Egyptians. You see, the Egyptians started seeing that certain things in this world should be written down and be shared with the future, because they may inevitably run into the same thing in their own time. And having that recorded history might be of great value. Well, almanacs really became a big thing in America right before the Revolutionary War. In fact, a very famous almanac was written called the Poor Richard's Almanac. It was started by Benjamin Franklin, started in 1739. And Benjamin Franklin really believed this was important for this fledgling continent. And the reason why is all of these new explorers and people had come to America, and they didn't know a lot about where they lived. And so starting to write down some of the important things of when seasons began and when they ended, when should you plant crops and when should you harvest them, what type of different meteorological events seemingly come and go with the passing of time. What things are on the calendar? All of that was so important in colonial America. And so when he stopped doing the almanac, he did it for one reason. That was because he had a country to help build, and he took time away from that Poor Richard's Almanac to focus in on creating the country that we live in. But then another group took on this almanac. It's the Farmer's Almanac. And that went on from Benjamin Franklin's time even all the way today. You could go to Amazon. You can probably find it in your local grocery stores, where you can see a 2024 almanac, which will tell you all the information of previous years and then tell you what you can look forward to in this year that we're in now. It would have told you in previous almanacs that a Monday in April 2024, there would be a total eclipse, and where it would be seen and where it could be experienced. This is the type of stuff that almanacs were made of. There was one final almanac that was a famous one, and that was Gray's Sports Almanac. And this is for my generation, because in the second Back to the Future movie, this is the point of contention. The bad guy gets the almanac from earlier, and he goes to the future, and he begins to start betting on future events, of which Marty McFly has to go and take care of it. So some of you have no idea what an almanac is. Now you don't know who Marty McFly is. I've lost you already. Now, the cool thing about the Gray Sports Almanac is that it playfully and laughingly said that the Cubs would finally win the World Series in 2015. They were off one year. Pretty amazing thing that they would be that close on the historic win for the Cubs. But with all of that, you ask the question today, Tim, what in the world? Why are we talking about almanacs? And it was when I saw this quote that I thought this was a really great way to explain what we're going to see in Daniel 11. Almanacs are like old friends, one person said. You turn to them for advice, comfort, and nostalgia. But it's the second part of the quote that I think is most apt for Daniel chapter 11. They hold the wisdom of the past, guiding us to understand the present and give us a glimpse into the future. I believe that in Daniel chapter 11, we've got a whole bunch of history, and we're going to talk about that in some detail. But I believe knowing the history of Daniel 11 helps us to better understand our present. What are we to be doing now? How are we to live? What are we to position our lives around? And what are the priorities that we ought to have? But I also believe, and we as a church believe, that after our passage in Daniel 11 and the latter part of Daniel 11 into Daniel 12, that it turns from history, and yes, even turns from the present, and it moves to future things. And next week, we're going to pick this latter part of the chapter up, and we're going to learn that some of the things that we saw in history are previews to what the future may unfold in the days, possibly years, decades, or maybe centuries to come. We don't know, nor do we know the hour or date that we've been told by our Savior that he's left to the Father. And so we've got this passage in front of us. A couple of things that I want to say about this passage. Number one, it is a difficult passage. For those that are in small groups every week, our small groups study the passage before us as preachers get up and preach it. And I got to imagine in every small group, upon coming to group and reading it, I think the overwhelming answer from people was, what in the world did this passage say? How many had that as a response? Let's just see a show of hands. Be humble enough, the rest of you are liars. I appreciate it. Because this passage is really, really hard to understand. This passage doesn't make sense. This passage had me dealing with trying to figure out, and I appreciate our tech team, how do I help communicate the complexities of this passage in a way that can be understood and that we can move quickly through it. Here's the thing. This passage is really, really difficult to understand, but there are going to be three truths that I'm going to put on the screen as my main points. That's where I want you to focus. That's where I want you to walk away with. There are three truths that this passage is going to teach us, God's people, that I think is really important for today. Surely very important when we see two major countries in our world now throwing missiles and planes and drones back and forth. Some of you were streaming Netflix that night and have no idea what I'm talking about right now. And we have another war breaking out. And it's not time to look at it, do it later. But it sure reminds us that we live in chaotic times. We live in a time and a season where a sermon series, Kingdoms, Chaos, and the Sovereignty of God is needed. And so Daniel 11 is our guide this morning to understanding the past and giving us a better understanding of the present so that we can then look to the future with confidence. To do so, I want to look at three headings this morning. Heading number one is that kingdoms have come and gone and still do. Kingdoms have come and gone and they still do. What I mean by that is we're in this vicious cycle of kings and leaders and all of that. And that's what Daniel 11 is telling. This perpetual cycle of intrigue and political events that are taking place and empires one-upping the empire before them and the desire of kings and rulers to rule and reign for all of eternity. And that cycle was going on in Daniel 11. And it's going on in our world today. As we look at this passage, we're going to see that unfold. So let's look at Daniel 11. We're going to read part of it, stop, explain it, and then move on. And as for me, this is the angel of Daniel 10, in the first year of Darius the Mede, that is also Cyrus of Daniel 10. It's the same guy, just different names. I stood up to confirm and to strengthen Daniel. That's what's happening. The angel's there to confirm to Daniel what's going to happen and to encourage him and to strengthen him. And now, he says, I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Stop. The first thing that Daniel 11 is going to do is this angel is going to come and tell Daniel one final vision. And this vision is connected to the other visions. The vision of Daniel 2, the vision of Daniel 8, the vision of Daniel 9. All of these different visions have taken place and they interconnect with one another. So in Daniel 2, it's the statue. In Daniel 8, it's the, in 7, Daniel 7 and 8, it's the lumpy, lopsided bear. Daniel says Babylon has come and Babylon has gone. Now we have the Median Persian Empire. And Daniel's question, no doubt, is this. How long is this kingdom, how long is this empire going to last? Is this the last empire? Is this the totality of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had envisioned, or is there something else? The angel says that the Persian, the Median Persian Empire, is going to last for four more rulers, and then another empire is going to come. Now, what I'm going to do on the screen is a couple of things. We're going to highlight who those four leaders are, and then I'm going to have an image on the back that's going to help explain it, and we're going to talk through all these things. So, here are the four leaders. We know this from human history. There are four leaders that are going to rule and reign, some for a long period of time, some for just one. This guy, Pseudo-Smerdis, he only reigned for about 10 months, very short time. But the problem with that is if we just go with those, we don't get as far as we need to the next kingdom. And so on the screen behind you, I'm going to have all of the kings that are there. And you're going to say, well, wait a minute, the Bible's wrong because it says four kings are going to come. And then another kingdom will rise up. The reason why is you're going to see a lot of similar names. You're going to see Cambyses, that's the first one. Then you've got Pseudo-Smerdis, that's that little one, 522. He goes by, these guys go by different names, just so you know, okay? They have different names depending on who's talking about them and what name they wanted to live with. Then you get Darius and you get Xerxes. And the Darius monarchy and the Xerxes monarchy have multiple kings. What the angel is saying is there's going to be four monarchies, and these four monarchies have to take place. It's not just four kings, but in essence, four kingdoms that are going to have to happen. So you've got Darius 1, Darius 2, Darius 3 down here way at the bottom. You got Xerxes 1, Artaxerxes 1, Artaxerxes 2, Artaxerxes 3, and then way at the bottom, Artaxerxes 4. And these are the Medes and the Persians coming in. Some are Medes, some are Persians, and they're coming in. In some ways, there's a little bit of political intrigue that's happening with these families. Also in this, you can see where some of the Bible passages come. So the book of Esther comes from the reign of Xerxes the First. And you're reading, going, wait a minute, Esther's way back in the beginning of the Old Testament. And the reason why is the Bible isn't written in chronological order. So there's different times and places. So Xerxes is where we're going to see Esther. Artaxerxes 1 is where we see Ezra and Nehemiah. And we see these things playing out. There's going to be four of them who are going to rule and reign over the Medo-Persian Empire. And then another one's going to come. So let's now turn the page. The Persian Empire is going to come and go. What's going to come in its place? Let's look. It's the Grecian Empire. And notice in verse 3 it says, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven. But not to his posterity, nor according to his authority which he had ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. So what we have at the very bottom in the green is Alexander the Great. He is the mighty one, the great one, who is going to come. He's going to come from the area of Greece, and by the time he's 32 or 33 years of age, he will have conquered the known world. In Daniel chapter 7 and 8, this is the leopard that has four heads and wings. He is swift. As quickly as the Greek Empire comes, it goes, and the reason why is because Alexander, at around 33 years of age, either is poisoned or dies of some mysterious death at the young age of 33. As a result of that, he has no posterity. Now, there's some speculation. Did he have children? If he did, they were too young to even think about holding it for them until they came of age, or he had no children at all. Alexander makes a decision that someone's got to rule his empire, and so he breaks up the empire into the oversight of his four generals. The four generals we see are here. I'm going to butcher some of these names. Seleucus, who was Syria and Mesopotamia, that was his area. Ptolemy, who was over the area of Egypt. This is the one I have fun with. Lysimachus, over Thrace and Asia Minor, that's modern-day Turkey. And then Cassander, who was over Macedonia and the homeland of Greece. Now, to help understand this, because this is where we're going to be going, we got to understand this kingdom. What happened was, is they broke up the kingdom like this on a map. Help me out here. Thank you. And what we have is, I want you to think of these as teams, okay? The orange here is the Seleucus team. They oversaw Syria, Iraq, Iran, all of that area. Then the pink one is the Ptolemy, and they oversaw Egypt, northern Africa, and all of that. Then you have two smaller ones. That is the green and the purple. Those are our friends Cass and Lissy, okay? Those two aren't that important. What you're going to have happen in Daniel 11, you start reading about the kings of the north and the king of the south, the armies of the north and the armies of the south, the prince of the north and the princes of the south. And we're like, what in the world? What is going on? What Daniel is being told is that for the next 150 some years, the orange team is going to wage war against the pink team. And if you notice, the army of the north and the army of the south. Why? Because Jerusalem's right here in the middle. Israel's going to be the epicenter of these battles that are going to go on for decades, this warring that is going to take place. That is what we see starting in verse 5, okay? Now, what you're going to see on the screen is all of the leaders. So let's turn the page to this. First, you're going to see the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. These are all of the different leaders. So when it talks about the king of the north, it's talking, this is the kings of the south, it's not talking about one king, it's talking about numerous kings over a couple hundred years of time. Then it's going to talk about the armies of the north and the leaders of the north. Here they are. And notice with each one, there's a verse that's corresponding with them. So we're moving through time very, very quickly. In a handful of verses, we will have moved about 370 years, okay? So we're going to keep cycling these things back so you can kind of be following along. And this is going to help you. This is why it didn't make any sense to you as you read. My job, my hope is that it will make some sense to you now. So let's read, starting in verse 5. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he, and shall rule his authority, shall be a great authority. After some years they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. And from a branch from her roots shall arise in his place. He shall come against the armies and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north. And he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first. After some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come up and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city. And the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, that is Israel, with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of his kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. Let's stop there. What you have in verses 5 through 20 is the ongoing battle between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire of a couple hundred years. Battles going back and forth. And what you're seeing is the days of lives of these different leaders and what's transpiring and what's happening, all being written with perfect precision. Then in verse 21, we get this new character that comes. And the new character, it says, is going to arise in the place of the one who was sent. In his place, verse 21 says, shall arise a contemptible person to whom the royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, and even the price of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plot shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He's going to go after the people of God and against the temple. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offerings, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, that is, he will flatter the high priest who he gets to do his bidding and his will to defile the people of God. And it says, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. Okay, so stop there. Tons of reading. It's like a page and a half of the scriptures, right? There's a lot there. Now let's go back to the two slides that we have. So go back, thank you. What we've got, let's start here. At the very bottom here, we've got Ptolemy the Philometor, okay? He's the last of the kingdom of the south. He is waging war, now let's turn the page, with Seleucus Philopater, okay? They are waging war with one another. There's fighting going on and all of that. They're even, listen to this, they're even going to merge together. The king of the north and the king of the south are going to merge together to fight against this guy at the bottom, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, we talked about Antiochus Epiphanes back in Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8, okay? And in that, we learned that this guy was about as bad as he could be. He takes all the others, you combined all of their bad things. Antiochus is on the Mount Rushmore of the baddest ones. Genghis Khan, Stalin, Mao, Hitler, and then there's Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes is going to be important, especially next week as we look to the future, because we believe that there are some characteristics of a future Antichrist that seemingly are close to what we see with Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I told you back a couple weeks ago that if you want to know about Antiochus Epiphanes, you want to look at 1st and 2nd Maccabees. These are Jewish historical books that were written between the time of Malachi and the time of Matthew, in that intertestamental time. They're not a part of our scriptures, but they're very helpful in understanding what this Antiochus did. All of this other stuff that I've read about, you can find in antiquity and in writings. There's a book that's written by a guy named Quintus Curtius Rufus. He wrote a book in Historiae Alexandrae Magnae, the history of Alexander the Great. He pinpoints all that transpires. So here's the problem. Secular historians say that the only way Daniel could have done this was that Daniel didn't write Daniel at all. That someone wrote the book of Daniel 400 years after Daniel lived because of the pinpoint accuracy of everything Daniel said. What God did through an angel is he foreshadowed and foretold 375 years with perfection human history. And so we're going to get to that side of it in a moment, but let's sit just here with all of these kingdoms. And let's understand a couple things. Kingdoms have come and gone, and they still do. What does that mean for us? There are two takeaways that all of this history should cause you to do. Number one, write this down. It should give you global perspective. It should give you global perspective and historical perspective as well. You see, with every generation, and we are no different in ours, we have hubris and arrogance because we use the phrase, and I heard it in the newscast yesterday, the word unprecedented, right? We heard that. We heard that with COVID, unprecedented. We've never experienced anything like this before. And all we have to do is, if we're real good students, everything that we think is unprecedented has already happened. It's already happened. Listen, it's already happened in our politics. It's already happened in our sports world. It's already happened in the world of intrigue and military conquest. It's happened. That's why Solomon was 100% right when he said there's nothing new under the sun. Wars have come, wars have gone. Armies have been raised up and armies have been docked down. Kingdoms have come and kingdoms have gone. We've been there, we've done that. What does it mean for us? But we don't need to freak out. The world is going to be like this. Jesus said this is what it's going to be like in the last days. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars. There's going to be eclipses. Last Monday, we had a whole bunch of more Christians saying Jesus is coming back on Monday. We're all still here. Well, there's all this pestilence coming. Have you heard? Listen. 2 trillion cicada are on their way sometime to arrive next month. The locusts are coming. Brothers and sisters, it has been going on for all of human history and it will go on to the end. And we don't need to lose our minds. We don't need to freak out. We know this truth. Jesus says, I'm coming soon. That's what we put our hope in. And we keep our head down and we keep doing what God wants us to do. It gives us perspective. Number two, it's a word of humility. It's a word of humility. All of this intrigue, all of this coming and going of kings, can I just say, all of them that are listed were more powerful than I am, richer than I am, had more possessions than I did, had more prestige than I did, had more influence than I did, had more geographical span to their kingdom than I did, and every one of them came and went. What that means for us, church, is that you and I are just like those kings. We're building kingdoms for ourselves. Our kingdoms aren't very big. My kingdom's about a quarter acre in the Hinckley territory, okay? And my kingdom isn't really big. I've got a queen and three princes and a dog, okay? And yet I'm building this thing, and I got a couple other side kingdom things going on. I got this catering thing that I'm doing, and that's a big one. Man, we're big in the Fox Valley area. Big kingdom. And then I'm doing this church thing, and it's Fox Valley too. We don't have any outside of Illinois. We really don't have anything outside of Kendall, DeKalb, and Kane County. But we think we're big stuff. Look at the kingdom I'm building. Look at the awards that I have. Look at the portfolio that I have. And Daniel 11, brothers and sisters, says, if you're building it for yourself, it's all going to be gone. It's all going to be gone. And that's why King Jesus said, seek first my kingdom, not your kingdom, not your possessions, not your prestige. Seek my kingdom, because my kingdom doesn't have moth and rust destroying it. It goes on forever. It has been said this, that you, when you live, whatever you build in one generation, it will be forgotten. Here's why. I'm going to live, hopefully I'll live another 50 years, maybe less, okay? You're looking at my physique going, you're lucky you got 20, buddy, okay? That's too much laughter going on, okay? My children will remember me. They will speak, hopefully, of how I lived in my community with them and with their mom. They'll talk about what I did in the catering world, that kingdom, and they'll talk about what I did in the church realm. My grandchildren will know some of that, but it won't make much sense to them. Think about what you know of your grandparents. Not that much. They want to sit down and talk with you, but you don't have any earthly time for that. And they want to tell you about what they've been building, and hopefully that you can inherit. But think about this. You get beyond your grandparents. What do you know of your great-grandparents? How many do you know their name? I know nothing about my great-grandparents. I couldn't tell you their names. I couldn't tell you what they did for jobs. The only thing I have of my great-grandparents, besides a couple black and white pictures, the only notable thing is that I had a grandfather who was connected with the governor of Illinois at the turn of the century, and he had a picture taken with him with Teddy Roosevelt, the president. That's all I got. I don't even know what my great-grandfather's name is. I just know the guy standing with him is Teddy Roosevelt. Why? Because Solomon again is correct. We are a vapor. We're here today. We're gone tomorrow. So folks, whatever kingdom you're building for yourself, if you think it's going to last, Daniel 11 is an open rebuke against you. It isn't going to last. Your kingdom will come and go. And the only thing will last, listen to me, church, will be the things we do for Christ. And so this tells us, maybe I shouldn't be so much focused in on what I'm doing, but focus in on what God is doing. Point number two, we're going to move quickly through these, okay, because we're running out of time. But point number two is another important truth. Kingdoms have come and gone, and they still do. Number two, God was in total control then, and he hasn't let that go. So amidst all this, God tells us what's going to happen 300 years before it happens. With perfection, he tells it. That means he knew exactly what was going to happen. That is, he's omniscient and he's omnipotent, that he could see through his sovereignty all of the plans, all of the decisions, all of the intrigue, all of the treachery of human leaders. And if he can do that with human leaders, he can do that with us. In Daniel chapter 11, there's a lot of sin. There's a lot of decisions being made. There's a lot of intrigue taking place. None of it thwarted God's sovereignty. None of it. Listen to me, friends. This is so important. God is sovereign. He is ruler and reigner over all things. Now, some of you are saying, but wait, we got free will. That's wonderful. That's great. You hold on to your free will all you want, but you got to hold on to the fact that no matter what happens, no matter what you do, God is utterly sovereign through it all. Amen. One pastor put it this way: there's not a stray molecule in all the cosmos. Nothing. Because the second there is, if there is anything out of the control of God, God ceases to be God. And we got nothing. Because if he's not in control, how can he promise the things he promises to us? And these leaders are conspiring. They're fomenting. They're doing all these things. And God says, you are playing it out perfectly. All of this is going to come together. And it's going to bring the perfect time where Galatians says, at the right time, God sent his son to be born of a woman to redeem those under the law. So what does that mean for us? Daniel 11 is confusing to us, yes. It doesn't make sense to us, yes. But what it teaches us is this: no matter what happens in our world, whether globally or personally, we can hold fast to the truth that God's got that and he's got us. That would be a great place for a amen. This kills our anxiety. This eradicates our worry. This keeps us from staying up at night. That's why the Prince of Preachers, Charles Spurgeon, said the sovereignty of God is the pillow on which every Christian lays his head. We can rest at night, no matter what's going on in our world, no matter how chaotic it gets, that God is in control. He was then, and he is now. And we can rest in that. And we can live in that. And we can hope in that. And we can obey in that, because God has got this, and he's got us. Number three. The third thing that we can take from this incredibly long and difficult passage is that the future, yes, can feel chaotic. So trusting God is required. So let's close this out. So later on in the text, we get to, starting in verse 33, it goes this way. And I'll start in verse 32b, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many may join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. So, amidst all of this craziness of Daniel 11, God stops and tells the angel, talk about my redeemed. Talk about those who love me and who are going to endure. Tell Daniel what he's supposed to know about his posterity. Will there be other Daniels? And the answer is yes. But the future seems chaotic, God. That's okay. Because we in the future will act as they did in the past. And there's a couple things that I want you to see. Number one, how are we to live in the future? Well, how are we to live in end times? Notice we're to live like they did in history, that they helped others to understand. You're doing what you should be doing during these last days, getting together and opening the book and sitting under teachers, and hopefully some of you being teachers are teaching others what it means to live for Jesus in our day. And that's what they were doing. And Ezra, and Nehemiah, and Haggai, and other prophets came and opened the word. And that's what I'm hoping to do today, is to help you understand this is how you're to live, to find truth in God's word. Number two, we're to carry one another's burdens. It says that some will stumble by sword, by flame, by captivity, by plunder. When they stumble, they should receive help. How do we help one another? In these last days, the future, there's going to be difficult times. There's going to be hardships. There's going to be troubles. And the people of God would need to band together more than they ever did before. And it means as a church, as we are growing, we have to get out of our comfort zones and help one another and carry one another's burdens. Number three, we teach the word, we carry one another's burdens, and notice, We recognize that suffering and tribulation is for our good. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join them. And some of them shall stumble. Some of the wise will stumble. And they may be refined, so that they may be refined and purified and made white until the time of the end. So we're going to stumble and fall. We're going to lack the faith at times that we need. But God's with us, and we got our brothers and sisters with us, and we need to recognize when trouble comes. We were talking about this in my theology class last week. Suffering is a good thing. Suffering helps us become more like Christ. It teaches us to have a hunger for eternity, not for the temporal. But as Christians, we have been told that suffering is a bad thing. So we pray suffering away instead of praying that suffering would become a part of who we are, because that worked in Christ's life and ministry, and surely it could be of great advantage for us to suffer for Christ's sake. And so how do we live in the future? We recognize and know that suffering will be a part of it. I know a lot of you will be nervous and worried about things that we'll share about the future in the weeks to come. And you sit there and you'll say, well, how can that be of any good? Well, it can bring great good, because suffering, James says, suffering and trials produces in us character, hope, and perseverance. And it gives us the opportunity to look forward to a crown of righteousness for all who have suffered for Christ's sake. And so what does this chapter do? Hard chapter, complicated chapter, difficult chapter. What the chapter has done for us, it has told us that kingdoms will come and go, and they still do. That God is in control. He was then, and he is now. Sit in that, live in that, love that. And even though the future may feel chaotic, we've got to trust God. And we can see that God in Daniel 11 is altogether trustworthy. He nailed it. And he's nailing what we need today. And we can rest in that.